another episode of the Hero Makers podcast. It's great to be with you guys. And we are like closing in on 25 episodes. This is like a mile marker, and our guest is clapping for us. And so this is exciting. And it's been 4 months, and we have had some great conversations. And we're excited because in about a week or so, we're going to be pushing out a podcast about the past few months and some of our favorite moments and some of the ways that we have seen our hero making traits be played out in the different episodes that we've had. So we're excited to push that out to you guys. But hey, Anne, so here we are in it's Christmas rolling around, and you have to tell everybody what you were doing this weekend because it was so exciting to me.
Oh, you mean the Christmas market?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, it was awesome. We just went last night, and it's outdoors. It was a little cold, so very few people were there. It was perfect. In the Distillery District of Toronto, which is where everybody goes to get their wedding photos. So you know it's pretty. Nice. All these red brick buildings, and it's obviously where everybody made their booze back in the day. Yeah. Oh, it's so awesome.
And quick story, I was in Milwaukee a couple years ago with my husband. And we went to one of the breweries there, and they took us on a tour. And it was like a 2-hour long tour. And yes. I'm so embarrassed to say this, but it's just funny. We went through this whole tour of how the beer was made and all this. And then we got to the end where it was like the tasting. And I was like super hangry by that point because it had been 2 hours. So we left before we even had the beer.
I felt so bad,
but I was like so hungry. I'm like, I can't tolerate beer without food right now. So that's my distillery beer story. And I'm excited about our guest today. And I feel like it's a little bit of a continuation of a conversation with an episode that we had just released with Jeff Spahr and Matt Kaplan, who are with Peace Love. And I think that was episode 22, if you guys want to go back and look at that, or listen to it. But Jeff was struggling, still deals with debilitating OCD. And he is just doing incredible, incredible work with using the arts to help people who are dealing with mental health issues, and just really powerful. And then before that, Anne, remember we talked to Sasha Wolf, who is with Still I Run. And so she's using running to help people who are dealing with mental health issues. So this is kind of our, I don't want to say it's a three-part series because maybe it'll just like, we'll keep going and going and going. But it's our number three. In this discussion about the importance of dealing with mental health and the way that people are creatively kind of empowering those who are struggling with mental health issue, and then like pushing us to be better and to breaking the stigma of this. So I want to welcome to the podcast our guest, Jay Schiffman. Jay, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. This is wonderful.
Yeah, and Jay is a founder of this organization called Choose Your Struggle, which you're going to tell us about, which is interesting because you're spinning that word struggle a little bit. In my mind, that's a negative word, but you're kind of turning it positive, which is exciting. And Jay has a podcast, and you're a public speaker and all those good things. So Jay, why don't you start by telling us a little bit about your own story and your own journey and kind of that led up to the start of your organization.
Yeah. So, thank you again for having me here. This is wonderful. I always love any opportunity to chat with people around these topics, and especially people who actually care about it. You know, there are a lot of people who, like mental wellness and everything has become kind of a buzzword, and they know that it'll get clicks and all that. But so people who actually want to dive in and, you know, get their hands dirty a little bit, it makes me really happy. So thank you so much for having me here. My story starts as a preteen. I'm 34, so this is the late 90s. And it's the era of the sort of great ADHD awakening. And to put this in perspective, when I was born in the 80s, roughly, 400,000 or so kids were treated for ADHD every year. By the time I'm diagnosed myself, that number has blown up to over 2 million. Young people in just a decade. And so every medicine company is coming up with new chemicals to try this. And a lot of those are great. And there are a lot of people who need this, but it was really overprescribed. And unfortunately, when you give young people who are going through puberty, and we all remember how much fun that is, you give them high levels of chemicals there's going to be side effects. That's just the way this works. Now, if you add in that this young person, in my case, also struggles with some low-lying mental health issues like depression, anxiety, OCD, as you mentioned, those three have been my big three most of my life. It creates a perfect storm. And unfortunately for me, my therapist saw this perfect storm and decided it was signs of a larger issue, which he called bipolar disorder. Now, unfortunately for me, we didn't get a second opinion, which is all too common in mental health. You know, when someone gets a debilitating, you know, cancer diagnosis, of course, the first thing they do is, great, I'm going to go get, you know, looked at another person. That doesn't happen in mental health. We kind of just take our therapist's word as gold. So by my late teens, I'm being treated for both ADHD and bipolar disorder. By my early 20s, really a year later, I am physically and mentally dependent on both these medications, all my medications. I'm overusing all of them. I'm misusing all of them. And at 23, I gave up. I attempted suicide twice. I overdosed. I spent a week in a lockdown unit. 3 weeks in a lockdown unit, 3 months in a long-term care facility before deciding that, you know, a change was needed. And I, you know, decided I'd been misdiagnosed, which was right, and spent the next almost 4 months going through step down detox to get off of all of my medications. And then the next 5 or so years rebuilding my life. You know, I'd lost friends, family, my career, the ability to go to school, all of that in a very short amount of time. And so that was the next 5 years of my life. And finally in 2015, when I really felt that I was in a good place, I started speaking about this experience that I've been through. And up until that point, I'd been very quiet about it because the stigma around these issues is alive and well. And that became my passion. And it was a thing I did on the side, you know, some one-on-one coaching and a lot of speaking about this. And then in 2019, I decided, you know what, I'm getting a second chance in a world where most people don't even get there first. And if I don't use this for something, I'm just wasting it. And so I dedicated myself to this company, Choose Your Struggle. And now, you know, for the last 2 years, that's been my life.
So, Jay, can you take us back to, like, that time when, you know, you had attempted suicide twice. You said you had lost friends and family. And, like, I kind of know what that's like. So I had struggled with an eating disorder for years. And I was in and out of hospitals and lost a lot of friends. And it was very, very painful. And I was actually on Xanax, which was really bad for me. So, but talk to us about, like, that time. What were the key factors that kind of helped you to say, okay, I'm going to fight for this. I'm going to fight for my health and my life.
Yeah, I wish I'd come to that realization earlier. You know, the reason I attempted suicide was that I had been given this diagnosis, which is a very serious mental health diagnosis. And like I said, I didn't get a second opinion. So I lived with this for about 5 years or 6 years. You know, I'm looking around at all these other people that I know who are on medications like myself. And for the most part, a lot of them were getting better and I wasn't. And not only was I not getting better, I was getting worse very quickly. And it's easy, I think, to understand with that knowledge why I lost hope. So, you know, I really was at a point where I had decided that this is my life and this is how it's always going to be. So after I attempted suicide and overdose and survived, it was in the long-term care facility, again, what we would have called a mental institution, you know, 50 years ago, that I start to get to know people, not only with, you know, serious issues of bipolar disorder, but also people who are struggling with substance misuse. And I'm looking at them going, you know, the people struggling with bipolar are like, I don't really identify with what they're going through. I feel for them, but our symptoms aren't the same. And what's so fascinating to me, I'm kind of a nerd when it comes to this stuff. Someone joked to me not long ago, with everything that I'm reading and I have read over the last 5 years, I could have had a master's degree by now, but I just enjoy learning about this stuff. And one of the things I did was I requested my treatment notes from this facility. And I've read in this therapist's notes about his own thinking is of, I don't think this guy has bipolar, but he wasn't sure what I did have. Oh. And because of that, he wasn't willing to let me get off my medications. Again, you can read in these notes about the day that I walk into his office and say, I want to get off medication. And he says, no, unless you're willing to immediately start with something new. And I said, ain't, you know, ain't going to happen. What finally motivated me was number one, that move of saying, I think this is what's happening, and having the therapist say, absolutely not. So I felt boxed in. Now, this place also was traumatizing, to be quite honest. And there was an experience towards the end of my 3 months there where a person I'd become close friends with, I was put in a position where I was the only person recognizing that she was showing signs that she was going to attempt suicide. And I stopped her. I was, you know, she didn't show up for meals and that kind of thing. And I happened to care enough that I went to her room and I stopped her from doing this. And kind of, it was like a whole night of activity of me talking her into not doing this and going to the nurse's station, all this kind of stuff. And the next day I went, you know what, you guys aren't supporting what I'm trying to do here. You know, this person would have been dead if it wasn't for me. I can't stay here any longer. And so that was what motivated me. I wish it was some, you know, grand belief in my own self, but that wasn't the case. That came later. But in that period, it was more a, I don't trust where I am. I don't believe they have my best interest in mind. I want to try something different.
That's really interesting, because there was like, it was kind of like that external motivator, right? That helped you to realize that, okay, this is not what I want. And Jay, can we just like quickly talk about though, like the importance of us focusing on just ourselves and like what's going on inside of ourselves? Like, so you were on these medications, wrong medicine, wrong diagnosis. The doctors weren't really willing to adjust things for you. But yet inside of you, you knew like that there was something wrong. And I think that, okay, so that's like self-reflection, right? Talk to us about the importance of us understanding ourselves in order for us to be kind of the best person that we could be. I think sometimes a lot of people tend to like either poo-poo off like some of the things that we're going through, or we just, you know, we're in denial, or we just like rush through things. Like, I don't want to deal with this. Just don't even, I'm trying to live life in the day, in the moment. But we actually need time, right, to understand what's going on inside of ourselves. Can you talk to that for a minute?
Yeah, I am a huge proponent of mindfulness. Now, I for a lot of people, when you say that word, it basically translates one-to-one to meditation. And that doesn't have to be the case. In fact, I do meditate on occasion. It, to me, at least, it doesn't give me the benefit that I'm looking for. And so there are a bunch of the other practices that I do on a regular basis. To the exact point, Lori, is to get to know what's happening inside of me. I love this analogy I was given years back by a therapist, is that essentially our brains, our subconscious really is a garden. And what's going on down there, you know, a lot of it is good things. A lot of it is beautiful flowers that are growing, but there's also a lot of weeds. And like in a real garden, you can't just grab a weed and pull it up. You got to get down there and really tear it up from the root. But the only way to do that is by knowing it's there in the first place. And if you don't take time to sit with yourself and understand what's happening inside your brain, that weed's going to blossom and you're not going to realize it's there until it's too late and you do something, you lash out, you whatever. And so that's why I'm such a huge proponent of mindfulness, is it allows me to get in and understand what weeds are growing. Mm. You know, I think that a lot of times we do things acting on a surface emotion. You know, anger is the most surface emotion, right? It's an easy emotion. It's a very easy one to feel. But if you don't take the time to understand where that's coming from, you're not going to solve the issue. Sure, you're going to let out some steam and you're going to feel better for the moment, but you're not actually going to get to the bottom of that emotion. And so, you know, a lot of anger comes from fear, it comes from sadness, it comes from all these different places. But if you don't get down there and understand what it is, you're just going to keep repeating it, because you're going to tear that root off of the top and it's going to grow right back up.
So on the show, Jay, we talk a lot about people sharing their stories. And you have said empathy begets empathy and vulnerability begets vulnerability. When you first started to share your story, was it hard for you?
Oh my God, yeah. So I shared it for the first time in 2015 at a storytelling event. And I'm really lucky that one of my good friends, I'm from Cincinnati, Ohio, and he runs an event called Cincy Stories, where well-known or influential Cincinnatians get up on stage and tell their origin story. And he approached me and asked me to tell mine. He was one of the few people who really knew my story. And I literally said, hell no, never going to happen, right? I said no to him three times. Mm-hmm. And the third time, I happened to be coming home to see my parents for dinner that night. And I walked into my dad's office, and he was sitting there reading the New York Times. I remember this scene like it was yesterday. And I start talking to him about how I have this, you know, my buddy wants me to do this thing and everything. And he says, well, why wouldn't you do it? I was like, because I'm terrified. You know, this is a big deal. And he lowers the paper. He looks right at me and he says, fear is never a good reason not to do something. And then he picks back up the paper as if he doesn't realize he just blew my entire world apart. So the next day I call my buddy and I was like, ask me again. And he was like, oh my God. So now I actually have to do the story, you know, and I tried a couple different ways and I finally find one that I think is going to work. And I call a really good friend over and I read it to her. And by the end, she's bawling. And I was like, okay, I've got this, you know? So I get up on stage the night of this event and I tell the story. You know, I'm very nervous. There's 150 or so people in the room, of which maybe half are good friends or good friends of mine, most of whom don't know this story. You know, a lot of them knew I just disappeared for a couple of years. They didn't really know what was going on in my life. So I tell the story and I come off stage and I fully expect that's it for me. I work in nonprofit fundraising, which is very relationship driven. My side work is in politics, again, very relationship driven. I'm like, I've just made myself a pariah. That's it. My career is going to be over. And the opposite happens, you know, just a crush of people so proud of me, so happy, so amazed that I told this story. And that event begets another one. I get invited to do a TED event. That gets me invited to another speaking engagement, and it's just been going ever since. And so it was so hard to do because of the stigma around these issues, because, you know, we see people who use drugs at all, especially those who misuse them, as failures, as others, as, you know, monsters. Our president literally called people who struggle with addiction monsters. So that's sort of the prevailing thought around this. And someone asked me, I was at an interview probably 6 months ago, and they said, well, why did you think that, you know, this was a big deal? Why did you think you couldn't tell people that you were a failure? And it knocked me on my ass because I'd never thought about that before. And I said, frankly, I just, like, no one ever told me that. I just internalized that from the way that we talk about people like me. You know, in that storytelling event, I mentioned that when I think about addict, quote unquote, I wasn't picturing myself. And yet here I was, someone who lived through it. That's just the way that we stigmatize people who struggle with substance misuse and mental health. And that's a big reason why I do what I do now, is to help change that narrative.
Wow. Jay, I really, really appreciate what you're doing and the courage that it takes to do what you're doing, because I think in society, like you said, we just receive so many messages, hundreds a day, thousands a day, of what normal is, and anything outside of that is abnormal and bad. So then I think the messages that you're communicating is helping to offset, you know, the wave. I mean, it's going to take a lot more people. So, you know, if you're out there, keep going, like, get together, do your thing. And so I really want to say thank you for that, because I, like, it's so important. Then more people will say, me too, right? Yeah. And I identify, and so relatable. So I'm also actually tearing up right now. So anyway, don't cry. But I just want to say thanks. And also, thank you, Dad, for knowing you. He gets a little shout out and, like, yeah. So good. And I'm really, you know, I think that you do must have, like, a really supportive family through all this.
Yeah, you know, it's really funny about that story is it wasn't like my dad was the most woke about these issues. He is now. My whole family has, you know, sort of made this journey with me because I forced them to. perfect example is my dad used to be the kind of guy where, and like most people, I don't blame him for this. When you think of substance misuse recovery, you think of 12 steps, right? You think of people who are sober, and that is a lot of people, and that's perfectly fine. It's very great for a lot of people. That's not my story. I'm really lucky. I've never struggled with issues of alcohol use. So I can have a drink with my wife and not need 10 the way I needed 10, 12, 15 of my prescription pills. You know, my dad would ask questions that weren't, it's not that they were ignorant, it's that he just didn't know better. So he would say, you know, well, but you're not sober. Can you really say you're in recovery? And quite frankly, he wasn't alone. A lot of people ask those questions. And there are a lot of people who think that if you're not sober, you're not really in recovery. They've all made such great progress because we've had these conversations. And my parents came down to see my wife and I in Charleston right before COVID. I mean, I think it was, this was November or December. And we were at a table in a restaurant that really was not that well populated. Weirdly enough, the only other table with people at it was two tables away was Lindsey Graham. Senator Graham was sitting there, and then my family and I are here. And we ended up getting into a very spirited discussion about mental health and substance misuse, because I kind of was like, you know, I love you guys, but some things you're saying are really out of date, and you need to know that. And it opened this whole like half an hour of basically my mom and I just going back and forth in a excited way, not like an angry way. But it was really interesting that was where we kind of went when we were together, was me needing them to understand that I needed them to be, it wasn't that they were not supportive, is that they weren't as knowledgeable as they should be. And, you know, some of their ideas about who should go see therapists were very out of date. And so it was a very informative discussion. Now, you know, I'm the weird one, quote unquote, in my family, who's always like, so, you know, how are your therapists and what's going on with that? And, you know, my brothers are like, come on, man, can't we just watch the game? why do we have to do this? It is a conversation that has evolved over the years as I've become more and more passionate about this. The same way that when I worked in politics, you know, I had to press them sometimes about, well, do you know X, Y? You know, I've seen how the sausage just, you know, gets made. And quite frankly, after enough of that time, you want no sausage. So there's a lot of those kind of discussions.
Oh man, that's a good analogy. We're all on a learning curve, even your family. And so it's like, obviously they love you because they're like willing to grow.
Yeah.
So that is awesome. I don't know if you've checked out our website, but we have 9 traits of heroes. And so as you're just talking, you mentioned a little bit ago about, I mean, that if you're going to do this, you want to help other people. And so I really think the hero trait of intentionality is really critical for you. And like, can you talk to us about like that mental shift into that?
Yeah, I am incredibly lucky in that one that I have to give thanks to my family for that. There was, I come from a line of people who the most important thing you can do was 2 things. Number one is being involved in the community. You know, we grew up sitting around our dinner table, recognizing our privilege, right? We didn't have those words for it that we do now. But a lot of it was, I joke with people all the time that my parents never asked us what grades we were getting. It was, what nonprofit are you involved in? What are you guys doing outside of the classroom? But the number 2 thing was what we call the do-say, you know, a commitment or your do-say ratio, right? And that is, if you say you are going to do something, what percentage of the time do you do it? And so I had friends who could not understand why I would get so angry if they're like, yeah, we're going to go out Friday night. And then Friday rolls around like, yo, what time are we going out? They're like, oh, we're going to stay in tonight and play video games. I'm like, no. You said we're going out. I've been ready all week. What are we doing? And that's just because how I was raised, right? If you say you're going to do something, you're going to do it. And that can be as little as, you said you're going to take the trash out, so you're taking the trash out, or something really big. And so following that passion for me of being like, I need to be intentional about this. I am saying I'm going to commit myself to it. And it makes it hard to turn off sometimes, because it's like, yeah, I could kick back with a drink and watch Celtics play. I'm a huge Boston Celtics fan, but maybe I can also be on my phone chatting to someone who needs someone to talk to in the moment while I'm doing that, you know? And so it leads me to my wife sometimes being like, hey, you can take the night off, you know? Mm-hmm. You can sit down with me and play a game or something. Mm-hmm. Because I just feel like there's so many people who need help, and sometimes that does get overwhelming.
That's interesting. You're very mission-driven. Right. Like, yeah. if you're that committed. Yeah. My personality is like, I tend to, I'm a 7 on the Enneagram. I don't know if you know much about the Enneagram, mm-hmm. but where I have a lot of big things I'm dreaming up. And so it's good to have people who are very committed, like to, you know, this is your calling, this is your mission, and you know it. So Jay, can we just like quickly, before you talk about choose your struggle and about that term, because we want to hear about that term. So when I think of substance misuse, I think of the opioid crisis. Like, that is the very first thing that comes to my mind, right? Like, we have significant problem here in this country that I think we're addressing on some level, right? But so talk to us about the term substance misuse, because we want to make sure that people like know, like, you know, hey, we're not telling you a Tylenol is bad. Or here's the thing about that term, but then also like, what are some of the signs that somebody is misusing their medications?
Yeah, so there's a lot in there. Number one, substance misuse versus substance abuse versus addiction is a big one in today. The reason that those of us like myself who use substance misuse is twofold. Number one, the word abuse is a very violent word, right? Nothing good ever comes from abuse, right? It's when you think of abuse, you think of spousal abuse, you think of violence, and that doesn't really fit around you know, misusing a substance, right? The second part is that when you are abusing something, when you say substance abuse, you're almost saying that nothing good can come of this at all. This is a substance that you're abusing, when in reality, it's not really the substance's fault, and it's not really your fault. Like, we don't really understand the full equation yet for what makes someone struggle with substances. Now, we know different factors, of course, but we don't know the exact equation. Until we do, blaming the substance or blaming the person is foolish. And so when you say the words, the term substance misuse, what you're saying is this substance has a lot of fine uses. Now, there's also a lot of bad ones that come with it. You know, alcohol, a lot of people love. I can use it very safely. There are also a lot of people who misuse it and have to drink 10, and that's just the way that their brain works. So saying that kind of lets the person off the hook and lets the substance off the hook. It's a more progressive way of talking about this issue. And then addict is sort of the thing that, you know, you would never call someone struggling with cancer a cancer, right? That's just a horrible thing to do. The same thing with calling a person struggling with substance misuse an addict is it's not who they are. This is a thing that is going on in their life. So, you know, I definitely applaud the medical community who have switched that terminology. You see substance use disorder a lot more now. We're also trying to move away from that long term because the word disorder has so much stigma around it. And so substance misuse is sort of the catch-all for the more progressive part of this community. And I really appreciate you giving me the opportunity to talk about that. That's something that I'm passionate about because I think words matter when it comes to stigma. Mm-hmm. And until we can change this. Now, I respect a lot of people who still call it substance abuse. I think that eventually we're going to grow out of that word, but we're not quite there yet. Now, as far as the opioid epidemic, it's been incredible that it's getting the notice that it deserves. You know, if you think about it, so this is the stat I always drop. 75,000 roughly is the amount of people who overdose every year. And that's just, and die by overdose, right? So that's not even, you know, overdoses total, which by the way, one estimate put those at more than 80% of a raise in overdoses during the pandemic. So this is exploding all around us. This is just the people who die from it. And this isn't all the other causes of death that come from substance misuse. So the opioid epidemic has really brought a lot of focus to it. The negative side of this is that there are a lot of people screaming about why didn't you pay attention when this was the same numbers 10 years ago for heroin and 20 years ago for heroin. The crack epidemic in the 80s and 90s, it was killing just as many people. Unfortunately, they were people of color, and quite frankly, this country just didn't really care as much. So they focus on the crime aspect of it, but they didn't focus on the people who we were losing. So there is a mixed bag there that it's like, yes, it's awesome. We're finally giving this attention. Why now? And obviously, we have some answers for that. As far as the signs, it's really a very person-centered thing. You know, I was able to hide it really well for the first couple of years. By the end, everybody knew. I didn't know everybody knew, but everybody knew. The number one thing is if someone who truly cares about a thing, whether it's a hobby, a person, or their pet, whatever the case is, all of a sudden doesn't really show the signs of love or interest in that thing anymore, that's a pretty big red flag. Now, that could be depression, because depression also has that sign. But if all of a sudden, you know, a person who really cares about how they look isn't really, you know, paying much attention to their appearance. If someone, you know that their dog is their best friend in the world and dog's going hungry, these are signs that something's going on and the signs that you should reach out and ask, hey, is everything okay? I'm kind of worried about you.
So I'm just going to go back quickly, Jay, to what you said about words matter and about the difference between, like, you know, an addict versus somebody who has maybe an addiction. That was something that I've learned years and years ago. Like, when people who are living in poverty, people will say, like, oh, that poor person, mm-hmm. as opposed for that person who is living in poverty. Right. And I think that is actually a very, very important point, because it's about labeling, right? Like it's giving somebody a label that is not who they are, right? And in the Christian world, so I'm a Christian, but it's like the sinner and the sin. Like you don't confuse the two. The two are always separate. And so like, I want to make sure like people really hear that like people who are struggling with an addiction or who are misusing their medications or who are dealing with OCD or anxiety or depression, like that is not the sum total of who they are. Right. Yeah. So, okay. So talk to us about choose your struggle, about that phrase, that why you chose it, and then how you're kind of like flipping struggle into something good.
Yeah. So we have this idea that struggle, that no one should ever struggle. And this is something that we hear about in the medical community a lot because pain was the fifth vital sign. That was really what kicked off the opioid epidemic was, you know, doctors being taught that they need to make sure that their patient is never in any pain. Well, that's not really reality. I'm 34 years old. I wake up with a tight back every day because I have not a great lower back. That's painful. Now, am I going to go to the doctor? No, that's just my body. That's just the way that it works. You know, my wife was having pain in her feet because she was running with not great shoes. She's not going to go to the doctor and make sure that pain gets disappeared from her body. There is pain always in our lives. And so this idea that we had to over-treat or we had to treat away all pain was what led to the opioid epidemic. Well, life has struggles in it. You know, I have the most immensely privileged life. I'm annoyed right now that, you know, the other day somebody stole the bag off my bike. And now I have to struggle to figure out how I'm going to replace that. You know, it had all my replacement tools in it. That's just annoying to me. That's a struggle that I have to go through now, is to replace this thing. It's a very small struggle, but that's what life is. Life is full of struggles. And when I was at my worst, which was 2008, 2009, I'd really lost the ability to sort of choose what I was going to struggle for every day. My struggles were to get off the couch. My struggle was to avoid withdrawal. And if anybody's listening that's ever gone through withdrawals, you know how big of a deal it is to avoid withdrawals when you're struggling with substance misuse. I didn't get to choose anymore. Those were chosen for me because of the situation that I was in. Now that I'm in recovery, I sort of had this epiphany that a lot of people sort of allow their lives to have the same context. Now, obviously much more different substances to use use the word there in a different way. But that, you know, whether it's that they're following a career path because mommy and daddy one day said when they were young, you're going to be a doctor. Now everything they've done for the next 20 years is to be a doctor, or they're following this idea that we get from everywhere, which is, you know, get the job with the high paying, you know, salary and the car and the house and all this ridiculous stuff that doesn't really matter. We don't choose these things. We sort of have this built into us that this is what we should be struggling for in life. Now, the sad part is people get to the end of their lives and they have this epiphany of going, oh my God, none of this mattered. You know, nobody gets to their deathbed and go, God, I wish I spent more time with Bob in accounting. That's just not how any of this works. You want to spend some more time with your family. You want to have a bigger impact. You want to have more time to be out in the community doing what you love. So one of the things I work with clients is that aspect, right? Is challenging these ideas that we have that really are built on nothing. And the one I hear the most, and it makes me so sad, is people saying to me, well, I could never do X. I could never follow my passion. I could never whatever. And I say, why? Every single person, they can't explain it. They always have this idea of being limited with nothing built on that. And helping people overcome that. You know, I had that happen to me, where I said, you know, I was doing this on the side for years, about 3 years. And I was in a career that I liked a lot. I wasn't fulfilled, but I was good at running political campaigns. And I said to my career coach, who was helping me get better at this job, you know, I could never actually do this work full time. And she was the first person to say, well, why? You know, and she helped me understand that I'm already doing this for free. I'm so passionate about this. Why not do it full time? And the answer was, I didn't have an answer. I just said I couldn't do it. And she helped me get over that. Now here I am 2 years later, I've been doing this full time and thriving. So, you know, the idea of choosing your struggle is recognizing whether it's a little thing or a big thing, you do have a choice. And if you allow some of these, I don't want to call them lies because it's not like anyone intentionally has chosen this a lot of the times. It's just things that we believe that aren't quite true. But you can make a difference in your own life.
I have so many comments right now. I would just like to say, I think you're right about society and about our understanding of pain and that we don't like it. And we work so hard to avoid it. We work so hard to mask it. We work so hard to deny it. And I think that actually then contributes to fear because we don't want to be awkward. We don't want to fail. We don't want to try because we might fail because of the pain of failure. And then I think we just get really limited and we start telling ourselves messages or, you know, or we try to work so hard. So like, how do you help people embrace pain?
Yeah, I want to say first that there are people who that's their idea of a good life is an easy life. You know, it's they're never going to be wealthy and they're never going to be. It's just an easy life. And for them, I applaud you. Like if that's really what you want out of your life, then bravo, you found it. You know, enjoy your life. And then there are others who have these incredible aspirations. And to your point, and they never follow them because they're so scared of failure. And I get it. You know, I if someone told me that the payoff could either be that I was going to be fulfilled completely and follow all my dreams to success, or I was going to be back where I was in 2009, I probably wouldn't follow that passion because that is a terrifying prospect to me. But quite frankly, that's not the case for a lot of people. You know, you try something that doesn't work, usually you're going to have another option. And you know, there's an exercise that we do with people who, you know, like me having anxiety. It's all right, what is the best case scenario? Okay, well, you know, this is going to happen, that's going to happen. Okay, what's the worst case scenario? Well, this is going to happen. Now, 99% of the time, it's exactly between those two things. It's not going to be amazing. It's also not going to be terrible. So what does that middle ground look like? Well, it's probably going to be this and that. All right, are you okay with that? And if you're okay with that, then it's worth doing because 99% of the time, that's what's going to happen. But we get caught up in these fantasies of, okay, if I try this, it's either going to be incredibly successful or it's going to be my absolute nightmare. And in reality, that never happens. Yes, occasionally it is that thing, but it's so rare. Is it really worth not doing because you're terrified of this? Or to be honest, is it really worth chasing if you are so sure it's going to be this thing because it's also not going to be that? It's going to be somewhere in the middle.
I think, Jay, like that, yeah, there's like this phrase, right, where like 99% of what we fear will happen never happens. It's like, yeah. It's very high. Okay, one more question before we need to wrap up. Okay, you said something that substance misuse has increased by 80% during the pandemic. Is that right?
Close. They believe that overdoses have increased by 80%. I gotta give a little asterisk there. Unfortunately, it could even be higher because those are only the ones that require EMS to show up, which means people who don't report or people who, you know, so sad you see those stories of someone who gets dumped at a hospital. Those don't even count in those statistics.
Yeah.
So this is just EMS reports to an overdose. They believe it's roughly between 70-80% of an increase during.
Okay. So, which is very telling because like there's other studies that show that the rates of depression and isolation and loneliness are also increasing, that domestic violence is increasing. The numbers are outrageous here that are going on during this pandemic. So here's my question. How do we as a community come around these hard issues where people are struggling and work together and support each other?
I would say number one, it's sort of sad to say, but there are beliefs that there's going to be a silver lining of this. And that is that because during a normal period, the estimation is that between 1 in 4 and 1 in 5 people will struggle with either substance misuse or mental health issues. During the pandemic, that estimation has jumped to 1 in 2. And so because of that, people who do these studies truly believe that, you know, if they look back 10 years from now, they're going to see this as a great awakening or great shift in our society around understanding issues of mental health. Because instead of going, God, I just don't understand what that's like, they're going to go, oh, wow, I remember what that was like during 2020. So part of that is sit with this, recognize how you're feeling right now and hold on to that so that next time when you hear about someone going through this, you can go, I know exactly how they feel. I felt that for an entire year and it was horrible. I can't imagine living that way. So that's number one, is that empathy hopefully will rise because people will understand about this. Now, during the spring of this year, when this first hit, I lost 5 speaking gigs in 2 days. And it was right after the NBA canceled the rest of their season, which is kind of when we recognized that, you know, the pandemic really exploded. I had five lined up and they all went away. And I was like, oh man, what am I going to do? You know, I've got my podcast, but that's not really enough. What am I going to do? And so after a little bit of mourning, I'm not going to lie and say that I was immediately like, yeah, let's do this. Like, I was very upset. I decided, you know what, I'm going to get back to my why. And I threw up on social media, on my podcast, my website, hey, if you need someone to talk to, give me a call, find me online, here's my number, whatever. And I was swamped. It was unbelievable. The people who just needed someone to talk to, they just needed someone to validate the way they were feeling and tell them it's okay, tell them it's normal. You know, sometimes it was things like, God, I know people are losing their jobs left and right, but I am so annoyed by Sharon over there in marketing. Is that okay? Am I allowed to be annoyed? You know, it was a lot of things like that. And I would just sit there and talk to these people on Zoom, on the phone, chatting with a lot of them and just say, it's okay. You know, if you want some tips, I'm happy to give you some tips. If you just want someone to say you're allowed to feel that way, you know, it's okay. So that was my spring, was just talking to a lot of these people. And it really showed me that there are a lot of people who need this kind of instruction. So number one, I am so excited about these. It's trickling out schools that are putting in mental health classes. You know, growing up, I had PE, I had health, where I learned about sex and learned about what came into my body and how it affected my, you know, eating and all that. We never had any mental health classes. And you're starting to see that shift a little bit. That's number one. Number two is people who are being there for other people. You know, you're seeing a lot. I have a graph right here next to me about, you know, different ways to reach out to people, when it's okay, when you should, you know, how to reach out to someone if you think someone's you know, maybe experiencing suicidal ideations or depression, whatever the case is. And you're seeing a lot more of that information come out, because we were like, okay, we don't talk about these things and that means people won't do it, which is just ridiculous. And it's just flat out wrong. And so now you're seeing people who do this full time going, all right, quite frankly, enough of your BS. We know what we're talking about. Here is how you deal with these issues. And I think that's going to be incredibly impactful as people learn how to do this. And hopefully we'll see an overcorrection as people learn more about this and stuff will drop.
Can we add do you have that online? Can we add the link to your graph?
You know what I'll do is I can send it to you after this if you want to put, I have it a PDF, but I got it from an organization. And so it's from the Western Mass RLC, which is a mental health organization and a substance misuse organization in Massachusetts. Okay. So it's on their website. I have it right here. I can definitely send it to you.
We can include a link to that in the show notes. And then Jay, we'll just like send everybody to you. We'll just say overwhelm Jay with his inbox. So
I'm always here.
Yeah. And your website, jayshiffman.com. Right. Where can we find you on social media?
Yeah, I am Choose Your Struggle or Jay Shiffman on everything. So my website is jayshiffman.com. If you type in chooseyourstruggle.com, it'll also take you to jayshiffman.com. And I do want to say, you know, Lori said it, you know, I really want you to overwhelm me, because we have a saying, those of us who do this work, we'd rather spend 2 hours talking to you today than 2 hours attending your funeral tomorrow. Please reach out. Mm-hmm. I was where you are. If you're struggling right now, I literally attempted suicide twice. I felt that there was nobody in my life who would take my call, and I was wrong. So if you truly believe that as well, I'm raising my hand here. I will take your call. Please reach out.
You're not alone. Right?
That's right.
That's the message. But thanks, Jay, for being on and for reminding us of, you know, I think too, like one of the takeaways for me is that you're saying that there could be a silver lining to all of this. And you don't want casualties along the way, but I think it's amazing if we all can open up our eyes a little bit wider, and then that builds that empathy that we're going to need for the future. And I'm hopeful, you know, Anne knows me. I'm an optimist, and I'm hopeful that, you know, the next 5 years, next 10 years, we are going to be wiping out some of these really big issues. Yep. And so grateful for you, Jay, and for your fight to keep this going, even though with your family may just want you to watch the game sometimes. So take time for yourself too. Take time for just downtime.
I try. And I got to say, thank you so much for having me here. This was great. It's really a joy talking to both of you. And, you know, I have a saying, if I can reach one person, it's all worth it. So if one person hears this and knows that there are other people who feel the way they feel, you know, reach out to Lori, reach out to Anne, and let them know, because I'm sure they, as a podcast host, that's what makes me the happiest when someone reaches out and said, this got through to me.
All right, well, guys, so do that, right? Reach out to me or Anne or Jay, and we would love to hear from you. And Anne reminded me that I need to be telling you guys about our Patreon page because I keep forgetting. So head on over to our website, heromakersmovement.com, and you guys will find a link to our Patreon page there. And we would love to have you join our family for $5, $10 a month, whatever you want to give. We would love you partner with us in that way. Thank you guys for joining us for another episode of the Hero Makers Podcast. I hope you guys love this and share this episode with those you think need to hear it. And we'll see you guys next time.